This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can now grab as a podcast or download off our website at progressive.org. It's a real pleasure for me to have in the studio with me Alison Bechdel, who for 23 years now has been drawing the popular comic strip Dykes to Watch Out For. She now has an intense autobiographical graphic novel entitled Fun Home, a family tragic comic. Alison Bechdel, welcome to Progressive. Great to meet you.
Thank you, Matt. Glad to be here.
How would you describe the book?
Well, it's a very complicated book. It's kind of hard to put it in a nutshell. It's a book about growing up with my closeted gay father who may or may not have killed himself right about the time that I came out to my family as a lesbian. And it's also sort of a portrait of my dad, who was this very complex character. He taught high school English, but he also ran the local funeral home. That's where the title of the book comes from. We would jokingly refer to the funeral home as the fun home.
You know, when I came across that, I wasn't expecting to get that because I had read that it was about your father who was closeted and then the tragedy that befell him, but I didn't know we were going to get to the funeral home right away, and it reminded me of 6 Feet Under, the show on cable. Did you ever see that?
Yeah, well, that show is sort of a thorn in my side,
why,
actually.
Why is that?
6 Feet Under came out when I was a couple years into this project. This was a very long, intense project for me. The whole book took 7 years to create. And I guess it was like, I think this second or third year of working on it that 6 Feet Under premiered. And I didn't see it. I just like saw the ads for it and heard about this show about a funeral home family. And it was like, oh man, somebody's like telling my story. It was very disconcerting and discouraging. And I couldn't watch it. It just like enraged me that this thing existed. And I didn't watch it for years until like I kept hoping it's going to like get canceled. It's not going to be any good, but it seemed to get more and more popular every season. And finally, my agent told me that I should rent the DVDs and sit down and watch this thing because she actually suspected that someone might have overheard my story in a coffee shop somewhere and like turned it into this television show.
So Alison Bechdel, when you finally sat down and watched the DVD, what did you think?
There were very striking parallels. I mean, in the first episode, the father is killed in a car accident. There's this very surreal funeral in the family's own funeral home. That's something I also cover in my book. There's this wacky family, like the sister who drives an old hearse. I have a brother who drives an old hearse. There's a gay brother. You know, there's this gay element. It was kind of freaky. But the worst thing about it was really good. You know, the show was just really great. So I haven't been able to actually watch the first two episodes. That's all I've been able to bring myself to do.
I got through about season three or four with my wife. We became addicted. A lot of people get addicted to it. And we rented and rented and rented. And then finally I got sick of them. I didn't want to hang out with them anymore, basically. So we stopped. But it was interesting. Talk to me about a little bit more about what your father was like.
My dad was a really he had a public face and a private face. And his public face was very, very friendly and genial. And people loved him. People thought he was such a great guy. But at home, he was kind of a tyrant. He would really terrorize us and yell a lot and hit us. And my parents' marriage was not a happy one. So there was always this kind of disconnect, you know, this sense that he was this great guy, but he was also kind of a bad guy. And I tried to present the whole picture in this book, you know, to give a whole honest portrait of who he was without, you know, whitewashing things.
You know, it struck me, and maybe it was what I was bringing to the table, Alison Bechdel, but I thought in a way that there would be more anger in the book from you. There's a funny line, or an odd line, at not quite at the funeral, but I think when you're coming back from college, having heard the news about your father's death, and you meet your brother and you greet each other with, you describe it as a ghastly, uncontrollable grin or something like
that. Yeah.
Explain that.
Oh, I remember that. I got out of the car and my brother came down the walk and we both just like started grinning. It was like this insane, ridiculous thing had happened that we couldn't wrap our minds around. And somehow humor, you know, responding in a with that humor reflex was just like, I don't know, something that we fell into naturally. I mean, we were a very shut down family. And that's another thing that I try to show in the book. We were all very emotionally disengaged. And that's part of, I think, why we had such an inappropriate response. But I don't think, you know, I've started hearing from people who've also had these like inappropriate laughter reactions at funerals and things. So maybe it's not so weird.
Was any of that a sense that the distinction between the public face of your father and the private reality was somehow now, if not blown, at least kind of irrelevant, and you can, you know, act in a way that people aren't expecting, or was it just a kind of an instinctive thing?
I don't know. I, you know, at that point, we were just in shock. I wasn't thinking anything really.
And back to this feeling that I have that I was expecting more anger from you in the description, because in a way you bend over backwards to be generous towards your father, I thought. So I was expecting anger on a level of the suicide, if it was a suicide, and you depict it with more clues towards suicide than the other way around, I think.
Yeah, that's, I think it's how a I pretty read convincing
it.
Case.
That's how I read it too, yeah. And so I was expecting more anger in that way, and then anger in his scandal of sleeping with underage boys.
Right. Yeah. Well, I don't know why I can't get more angry at him. I mean, for one thing, he's dead. It's hard to like really sustain anger at dead people, I think. And he also was really, you know, he had some really wonderful traits. I do get mad at him. Not mad enough. You know, in therapy, I'm always trying to like work up righteous indignation, and it's very difficult to do.
Why do you think that's so hard?
Oh, God. Now I'm having like public radio therapy.
Now we're having therapy.
Well, I think, you know, we depend so completely on our parents for our existence. It's hard to break that habit of, you know, not wanting to get on their wrong side.
Mm-hmm. No, you try to rescue him at the end, too, by bringing him forward in time, by fantasizing, if you will, that he was out in the 80s, but then it gets tragic even in your mind, and that he then would succumb to the AIDS virus. And I was wondering why you brought him that way.
Well, you know, it's very tempting to think, what would his life have been like if he hadn't killed himself? You know, I want to imagine a future, but really I can't get very far because of what you just said. It's like, you know, I know he had sex. He would go out cruising in New York City. It's very possible he would have gotten AIDS. And, you know, especially given all the secrecy of his life, I just think that was a very likely possibility. It's also hard for me to project backwards. You know, what if he had been able to come out in his youth and live a more, you know, open, honest life, then I wouldn't have been born. You know, it's like, it's so, I can't really do a lot of projections.
Well, let me flip it a little bit, because then, I mean, toward the end, Alison Bechdel, you talk about, you say it would be problematic to make him a tragic victim of homophobia. On the other hand, he seems like a tragic victim of homophobia in the book to me.
Yeah, you know, in some ways I think of this book as a longitudinal sociological study. It's about these two generations of gay people, one who came of age before the Stonewall riots in 1969 and one who came of age about a decade after. My dad and I just perfectly straddle that historical moment. And part of what I want to figure out in the book is, you know, how much of what happened to my dad was historical circumstances, how much of it was his character. I'm very interested in questions of the personal versus the political and how those things interact.
You know, it's kind of like, I mean, my father has some traditional sexist and homophobic attitudes. And so I ask myself, should he be given a pass because he's, an 84-year-old man and that was his time? Or in giving people passes, that whole generation of people, that pass, what is that saying? Aren't people responsible for the choices and the time that they make them? I mean, those are hard things to wrestle with, too.
Yeah.
Now, you talked about the straddling here in time, your father being gay before Stonewall and you afterwards, and you mentioned early on in our conversation, Alison Bechdel, that you both came out in a way within weeks of each other.
Yeah.
That must have been freaky.
It was.
You were at college and you send a letter home.
Yes.
And take it from there.
Well, I had this big revelation at college. My coming out, another whole strand of the book we haven't talked about yet is that it's also about books and literature. My dad was a great reader, and each of the chapters of my book focuses on a different author or book.
And you got a love of books, it seems, from him.
Yes. And when I came out, when I realized I was a lesbian, it wasn't because I fell in love with someone or had sex with someone. It was because I read a book. It was this very cerebral process for me. But I figured it out. And I felt like I needed to tell my parents this important news. I wrote them a letter because we were this very, as I said, sort of detached, distant family, and a letter was the way we would do something like that. I sent them the letter, and it caused quite a ruckus. My mother was very upset and wouldn't talk to me for a couple of weeks, and my dad was oddly familiar about it. I wasn't sure what was going on. He was saying, oh, well, I think it's good that you're experimenting. The way he talked, it sounded like I was off having some kind of orgy, which of course I wasn't at all.
This is before you even had sex, you said.
Yeah, I hadn't had sex with anyone. And then there was this very complicated period of a couple weeks when I was having these phone conversations with my dad, and finally my mom wrote me a letter. And she alluded to how she had to deal with this in another form in the past. And I didn't know what she was talking about. Finally, on the phone, she explained to me that my dad had affairs with other men. And I was just floored.
Had you had any hint of
it? No idea. Although then, of course, I started putting it all together. And yeah, my dad was always a little effeminate. And what's with all the antiques and the flower arranging, It all started to fall into place. But still, it was a very confusing time because here I'd was coming along with my, great revelation, this coming of age moment, and I was just like shot out of the water with this much bigger problem.
And then the problem got a dimension bigger very quickly.
Yeah, I came dragging out their secret into the light of day, this difficult problem that they'd been hiding. I just stumbled along and acted like, oh, yeah, I'm a lesbian. And it just disturbed all the equilibrium. My dad started getting... I was away at school, so I didn't see this, but I heard from my mother that he was getting kind of erratic, more angry than usual, throwing a valuable painting down the stairs, and things started to unravel.
And your mom, about the same time, Alison Bechdel asked for a divorce,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, she did.
So the kind of carefully constructed facade was beginning to be torn.
Yes. And I always feel like it was kind of my fault. If I hadn't stumbled along like that, maybe he'd still be alive. Maybe they would still be living with their terrible secret. Who knows?
Oh, I don't know. Just from reading it, and I don't know your family. I mean, just the depiction of your family. It seems to me that things were going in an inexorable direction, and that in a way that your father didn't really know how to grapple with his sexuality or the acts that he did. At one point, he goes to a psychiatrist. This was after you describe he got in a little legal trouble.
Yes.
He bought a beer for an underaged boy who seemed to be picking up at the time.
Yeah, that was the surface story, was the beer. But the real issue was, what else was going on with this kid?
But that hadn't surfaced in your consciousness at the time.
No, I knew that my dad was in trouble that summer. That was when I was 13. It was the summer of Watergate. It all comes together in this big loss of innocence. So That was when I was 13. He almost got arrested, but somehow it all got smoothed over, you know, and he agreed to go to counseling. So he, you know, went to some kind of psychiatrist for 6 months just to fulfill this legal order. But
and the thing that's stuck in my mind, and I'm talking with Alison Bechtel here, who has authored an incredible graphic novel called Fun Home, a Family Tragic Comic. This is Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. The comment he made to when he had to go to the psychiatrist, I'm bad.
Yes.
You're good. I'm not as good as you are. Something like that. That's heavy.
Yeah, that was intense. He said, I asked him why he was going to the psychiatrist, and he said, I'm bad, not good like you.
And that's coming from a parent to a child. I mean, that is a kind of a role reversal because parents usually scold their kids for being bad. And how did you grab that?
I do feel like I'm in therapy, Matt. Well, it was a big weight to carry. Oh my God, I'm good. I have to be good. You know, I have to like uphold some kind of moral code that I don't even understand. There was that feeling.
Yeah.
I think my dad also really romanticized childhood in a way. I think he really thought children were, I remember once reading Huck Finn. I was in his English class in high school.
Well, that must be strange too.
Yeah, that's a whole other crazy thing. We were reading Huckleberry Finn, and I remember one class in which he went on and on about how no one is ever more moral than a 12-year-old child. That always stuck in my mind. Like he had
But that's
this...
not true.
But I think he must have been talking about himself on some level, you know, that somehow something went wrong.
Pre-puberty or something?
Yeah,
you think?
Yeah.
Is that what he's going for?
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Interesting.
Sexuality.
Contaminates
you. Mm.
Well, that's... I mean, it seemed to have contaminated him or the repressive culture that he was living in, that he couldn't act on his sexuality in a healthy way.
Right.
Or an acceptable way, certainly.
Right.
The funeral. Let's go back to the funeral a second, because I think funerals are strange and social customs are strange there. There's a situation where people are supposed to engage in the small talk. That's what you do. And you have a panel in this graphic novel where you and your brother want to scream at the people who are giving the conventional soothing comment that the
right.
Lord moves in mysterious ways.
Right.
And you just want to holler at them. What good would that do, do you think? Is it ever okay to do that in a situation like that?
No, obviously not. I mean, I don't know. I just it was just so odd for me because I had grown up in this funeral home, watching funerals all my life. And my family, we would always like sort of scoff at the hollow, empty ritual of it. You know, it just seemed absurd to us. And so it was tragic to me that my father now had to like participate in this charade. In some ways, I think that I had to write the book as a proper funeral. Like this is my father's true memorial, or whatever need we have, you know, to observe a person's death. That's what the book is for me.
Well, it's also a truthful eulogy, is how I would call it. I mean, I don't like eulogies that are just completely glossing over everything.
But isn't that fun? That's the root of eulogy. It's supposed to be all good, you know, good words.
I don't know. I think it should be a little more accurate.
I think so, too.
You visited the grave, you say, in this book, Fun Home, A Family Tragic Comic, Alison Bechtel. And there's a flag there.
Yeah.
What do you do with the flag, and what's that about?
At some veterans organization or something would put these little flags on the graves. My dad was in the Army after college. And I don't know. I just knew he would think that was so tacky, a flag. So I yanked it out of the ground and I like hurled it into the cornfield right next to his grave.
Was this an act of against tackiness or against what the flag stood for?
It was both. I was in my early 20s and, you know, it was all during Iran-Contra and everything.
What was your dad like politically?
You know, my family never talked about politics. It was almost like politics were like sex. No one discussed it. And I grew up in a quite apolitical fashion. It really wasn't until I came out as a lesbian that I had any kind of political consciousness. And that whole lesbian feminist movement of the 70s really like shaped my worldview completely. I think it was because my dad was probably much more liberal than the people around him, and so it was problematic to talk about. We grew up in this very small farming town. Everyone was Republican or, you know, assumed to be, and it would have been, I think, difficult.
Alison Bechtel, how hard has it been to write this book? It's especially hard, I think, for writers to write about family when family's alive. Obviously, it's about your dad who's not there, but your mom is still alive?
Yes, she is.
And how did she take this?
Well, it's been very difficult for her. And my mom's a really wonderful person. I told her I was going to do this book, and she didn't freak out. She was a little upset that I was going to be revealing all of this sordid history, because she's quite private. I don't think a lot of her friends know this stuff. But she never tried to stop me from doing it, because she also, she's a writer and a reader, and she understands the creative process,
And an actor. She's been an actor.
She's an actor, yes. Both my parents were, like, very, very creative. But I had an interesting conversation with her the other day, because she's starting to hear from people. You know, relatives and friends are calling her and saying, I saw this book. You know, they're a little concerned for her. And she says, I don't want to talk about it. And she won't talk about it. She won't talk about the content at all. She's happy to discuss, like, my ranking on Amazon.com for some reason, but she doesn't want to talk about the story.
That's the proud mama.
Yeah. It's this kind of schizoid response. But she said to me the other day, the story must be served. Family be damned. I wrote it down because it was so, like, stunning.
You know, I thought she was a very wise woman in reading the book, and that's such a wise comment.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's true objectivity, because it's very painful for her. I think she's reaching her limit, too, with the publicity.
That could be. How about your brothers?
I haven't heard. Well, one of my brothers is on the road. He's in a band, and he's on tour with Ministry on the Masturbateur this summer. And so he hasn't seen the book yet. I sent him a copy, but he never got it. And my other brother, I haven't heard from him. I don't know. We're just. I just learned that often families don't read memoirs. If someone writes a family memoir, the actual family members tend to not read it. And I can sort of understand that. You know, it's really, they have, I think, different, you know, a different take on everything than I did. And it's probably kind of jarring for them to have this out there.
I mean, I come from a family of 8 children, and I'm sure every single one of us has a different, somewhat different take on the family. So I'm, you know, we talk about our parents who are both alive, a little bit ill now, but still with us, which is great. But I think we all have kind of a different assessment one way or another, and that's tricky. And so I don't know how I would ever do it. So I admire you, Alison Bechtel, for your courage.
Well, it's not courageous. You know, I grew up in a very emotionally detached family, so I don't have the normal feelings of loyalty that, you know, you might have.
I don't know. It sounds to me like you have some loyalty towards your mom.
Well, I don't know. I think her friends would beg to differ.
Okay, well, friends are another thing there. And she understands what you're driving at with this book, it seems to me. What kind of reaction are you getting from people? I mean, there are families. Every family's different, obviously. Every family tragedy is different. But how are people reacting to the book?
Well, I'm kind of overwhelmed by what's happening with the book. It's really getting a lot of attention and a lot of people are buying it and reading it.
The book Against Fun Home, A Family Tragic Comic by Alison Bechtel.
I just found out it's on the New York Times bestseller list.
No kidding.
Number 30. I didn't know it went that low, but apparently
well,
it
congratulations
does.
Anyway. I mean, that's
kind of wild. I know people love family memoirs. They love all this truth-telling stuff, which is great, but it's still a little baffling.
And how were you able to do it at the same time that you were doing your comic strip, Dykes to Watch Out For? I know I just finished my first book. It only took me 48 years to write. And I was
congratulations.
I was doing it at the same time I was trying to edit The Progressive.
Yeah.
But still, juggling those things was hard for me, and it wasn't nearly the emotional archaeology that this book was.
Yeah, well, it was hard. It's all I did for 7 years. I would, you know, I'd work 2 weeks on the memoir, and then I'd do 2 weeks on the comic strip, and my house fell apart, and my relationship kind of fell apart. Oof. It's a crazy calling, graphic novel writing. It's so time-consuming. I mean, really, if you break it down to the hourly rate, it's really no one would want to do this. It's kind of crazy.
There seems to be in the last 5 years a boom in graphic novel writing. Why do you think that is?
Well, there's certainly a boom in you know, it's becoming an accepted literary form. It's crossing over from, you know, people have been doing graphic narrative forever in comics, but I think people are understanding more and more the real potential that this has as a storytelling format, and it's great. I'm really excited to be part of that. You know, I've been cartooning for 23 years. It's interesting to me to see this trend toward graphic novels becoming mainstream, sort of in the same way that gay and lesbian narratives are becoming acceptable fodder for the mainstream. And I'm just happy that my book is like was in the right place at the right time, you know?
Both careers have come along at the right time.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
Who are some of the graphic novelists you like or you would recommend to people?
I just read Craig Thompson's book Blankets. That was really great.
What's it about?
It's a coming of age story. This boy who grows up it's about Wisconsin. He grows up in Wisconsin as a his parents are like fundamentalists, and it's about falling in love. It's a very, very beautiful love story, and just about his, you know, grappling with his Christianity. Very beautiful book. Jessica Abel just wrote a book, a graphic novel, La Perdida, which is really great, about a young American woman who goes to Mexico, lives in Mexico City, like trying to find her Mexican roots. More and more people are doing these, you know, substantive things in graphic format, and it's very exciting.
Do you have another graphic novel you're working on or conceptualizing?
Yeah, I want to keep doing this autobiographical thing. I really like it. Just mining my own life. I'm going to turn my whole life over to, like, be a science project. I'm going to stop having a private life and just write about my life.
You know, some people give their bodies to science when they're dead, but
yeah, I'm going to do it while I'm alive.
And you're keeping this comic strip going?
Yes, I hope to.
And you never get tired of that?
No, I really love that.
23 years, how do you keep coming up with new ideas?
Well, I got many more ideas than I ever have room or time for.
Really? I just repeat.
Well, I do sort of. If you look closely, I do just repeat the same thing over and over. No, I want to keep doing that forever. It's hard, though, because newspapers are becoming such a difficult, you know, they're all struggling and
are they less less able or interested? Or?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm losing papers. Papers are folding. So, I'm trying to invest into I'm putting my strip online, but I have to figure out how to, like, make money at it, you know?
We're just about out of time. Where can they go to see the strip online?
DykesToWatchOutFor.com.
There it is, DykesToWatchOutFor.com. Allison Bechtel, author of Fun Home, a Family Tragic Comic. Thanks so much for being my guest.
Thank you, Matt. That's great.
A lot of fun.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.